Time to take a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller, and my guests today to help us out, they come by every couple of months on the first Wednesday of the month, David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie is a UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David, a professor in that same department. And we'll talk about a whole variety of things, the elk hunts coming up and a whole batch of other questions relating to what's going on in the world of wildlife. And I bet you have some questions as well. And if you do, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got an unusual sighting. Maybe you've got a question about a particular animal. Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Jamie Knack, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
And David Drake, thank you as well.
Thank you, Larry.
Here we go with an elk hunt. Some people were surprised when the elk hunt was announced, I think. How was it decided that 2018 would be the year to have the hunt?
Yeah, Jamie? So this is after 22 years of reintroduction efforts, so this is a pretty big moment in Wisconsin's history. But essentially, when they reached a goal, a herd goal of 200 animals, that is when a hunt was going to be an option for the state. And with the spring calving, we will be over that number. So efforts were put in the works, talk with partners like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and many other stakeholders, and they agreed to go ahead and have a hunt. So there will be 10 tags for bull only. The herd right now has a substantial number of bulls, and bulls are polygamous, so they will breed multiple does. So being able to harvest some of the bulls won't affect the population growth. And so this hunt, with the 10 tags, five of those tags will go to is our shared harvest with the
Native Americans.
Yeah, with the Chippewa tribes. And the other five tags, four of those will be a lottery. So if you're interested, by I think around May 1st, you can go into the Go Wild system and buy a $10 permit application, and then they will draw from them for winners. And then the other tag went to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, who will have a raffle to, again, raise money for conservation efforts for elk management in the state, habitat restoration, and that will go to a lucky winner there as well. So,
you know, we were talking about this on Easter Sunday. We're visiting with some folks, and somebody said, why the heck did we introduce elk in the first place? Why are they here? I had a little history, but I'm sure, David, you have a better history of this than I have.
Well, they are a native species to Wisconsin, so that's one thing. It's the restoration of the native biodiversity. Obviously, elk is a very large game animal, and especially if you're an elk hunter or if you're a hunter at all, people pay good money to go out west and go on guided or unguided elk hunts, and it's a very attractive species for people who enjoy hunting as well. So it's it makes sense, and as Jamie was saying, they've hit a goal of 200, and a lot of these animals that have increased that population are they've been bred here in Wisconsin and born here in Wisconsin. So, and the other thing we should say is there are two elk herds in Wisconsin. One's the Clam Lake herd, and the other is the Black River Falls herd. And the hunt only is going to take place in the Clam Lake herd. The Black River Falls herd is not eligible for the hunt.
Yeah. So if you're familiar with the recent introductions from Kentucky, this hunt does not target those animals. Actually, the original introduction was in 1995 from elk from Michigan, 25 animals. So it would be part of the genetics of that particular herd. But historically, elk were in 50 of the 72 counties in the state, and it was really from overharvest and the development or the harvesting of timber during European settlement that kind of had the decline. Then there was some assessments done in the late 90s, 80s and 90s, looking at whether it would be possibility of having either moose or caribou or elk reintroduced into the state, and elk look like the most promising. So it's taken a while. We've had our ups and downs with it, but we seem to have sure footing moving forward, and certainly a lot of interest again with the general public, tourism coming into that area of the state. It'll be really exciting.
Yeah,
a lot of people always, especially if you're a non-hunter, a lot of people will ask, well, why in the world do you spend all this time and effort and money to restore a population only to hunt it? But, you know, one of the things about hunting a population or a species of animal is you get a awfully passionate number of people who are advocating for that species conservation and sustainability. And that's one of the best ways to maintain, you know, a viable, sustainable herd or a viable, sustainable population, is because so many people are interested in it and they're willing to spend the money to support it, the conservation efforts and things like that. And so this is a culmination of many, many years of many different groups and people spending time, money, and effort to get to this point. And, you know, the fact that you actually are able to hunt a species means that the conservation is working, because you're able to sustain a harvest off of that species.
Well, we have callers online. Questions for you. Maybe you've got something other than an elk question. That would be just fine. I see Jeff has. We'll go to Jeff in just a second. For you, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And now let's go to Jeff. Jeff, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you. I feel like I have the best job in Wisconsin. I drive throughout northern Wisconsin doing deliveries, and I see a lot of wildlife throughout all the four seasons. And one of the things I'm noticing now, and I don't know if it's normal, but I wanted to ask if the wild turkeys, I see tom turkeys, the big ones, and they sit in the roadway, and they're shaking and making noise and stuff, and the females are running around crazy, and there's four of them, you know, and I see them on these country roads and stuff, and I'm like, get off the road. Why are they in a field? Or, you know, and then I see pheasants, ringneck pheasants, the beautiful green-headed ones that I always thought hung around by the railroad tracks because of the grain cars that go along. But now I see them in farmers' fields, and they're flying across the road, and they fly into the vehicle. And I mean, they're just, it's almost like they're attracted to the roadway. Is that normal?
Well, we are in late winter, so the time of hardship for wildlife, trying to find food, trying to find shelter. You mentioned you were in northern Wisconsin. I heard that there was quite a bit of snow there, yet maybe upwards of 20 inches in some places, plus the recent snow. So it becomes hard for them to find food. So we've got deer even in Columbia County, where I live, that are coming and feeding closer to the roadways. Pheasants and turkeys are naturally going to come in and look for grit that they will swallow, that helps them digest food in the gizzard. So they're often picking and scratching around on the roadways. You're right, railroad tracks too, with the spilled corn, and that's certainly something that we see during the fall harvest time, animals up along the roadways. But it may be just easier access through less snow cover in those particular areas. And again, at this time, we're starting to see turkey flocks break up a little bit, and some indications of breeding behavior occurring. So
that might be one of the reasons. Jeff, I'm not sure if you're seeing the male turkeys, the toms, displaying in the road, but one of the reasons they might be in the road is because it's easy for the hens or the females to see them, because it's such a wide open area, as opposed to some of the vegetation, you know, on the sides of the road. So they might be in the middle of the road displaying so they can be seen by the females in order for breeding purposes at this time of year, too.
Yeah. There we go. Thanks so much for calling, Jeff. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. For listeners who don't know, give us an overview of your work with the Urban Wildlife Project. Let's talk about that for
a minute. Okay, yeah, we sure will. This is something that Jamie and I are both involved in, and we've created a website called the Urban Wildlife Project, so you can just Google Urban Wildlife Project, or it's urbanwildlifeproject.wisc, the first four letters of Wisconsin.edu. And essentially, this is a comprehensive website to help people understand how to create, enhance, or manage habitat in suburban, urban areas to benefit wildlife. And the reason we're making such a push on this is about 85% of all Americans live in an urban landscape, and about 67, almost 70% of Wisconsinites live in urbanized areas. And so that's where most of the people are also interacting with wildlife. We don't, as a population, we don't go out into the country much anymore to go recreate and see wildlife. And so most of that interaction is occurring in those urban, suburban areas where we live. And so what we're trying to do is get people to understand the type of wildlife that live around us in those cities, how they can benefit the wildlife. And you know, generally, there's going to be an assortment of wildlife that are going to be in the city, regardless of whether we help them from a from a habitat standpoint or not. And an example would be a raccoon, for example. You know, you could pave over just about the entire city, and you're still going to have raccoons in the city. But what we're trying to do is not only promote habitat for the common species, but for some of the uncommon species, like you know, salamanders or frogs or some of the bird species and things like that, that typically would not be in that urban landscape if the habitat was not there. So we're trying to get people to provide habitat for the common and less common species. And a lot of times we get people saying to us, well, why do I want to provide habitat? Because I've got so many squirrels at my feeder, I'm only going to attract more squirrels. Or I've got, you know, too many crows in my yard, or whatever the case might be. And so there's a number of reasons we're trying to push this. And one is that there have been a number of studies that are done that the more habitat you have in your yard, the higher you can sell your house on a resale value for. So there's a, you know, you get increased property value. There have been a number of studies done in the medical and social literature that show that where you have, you know, trees and flowers and things like that around you that benefit wildlife, it also benefits humans. So we're healthier from a physical and a mental and emotional standpoint. It also beautifies your yard. And if you provide habitat, you can start to bring that wildlife more in balance. So, for example, if you've got a lot of squirrels, you might try to attract some owls or hawks or fox that will naturally take care of your squirrel problem, or at least keep that squirrel problem in check. So that's what we're trying to promote. And we're having a workshop on April 14th, a week from this Saturday, at the UW Arboretum from noon to 4 p.m. And so if people are interested in attending that workshop, we're going to spend the 4 hours inside talking about how to create, enhance, and manage habitat on your property, the types of wildlife. We'll go through a bunch of wildlife identification. We'll talk about how to develop a wildlife management plan, and talk about wildlife damage management, because that's certainly a component of this, as well as answer questions and just help people get a start on this. So if people are interested, maybe we can put it up on the Facebook page here, Larry, about the flyer for the workshop, or you can Google Dane County Extension Urban Wildlife Workshop, and you should be able to find it that way. It's $30, but I promise you'll get your money's worth plus some.
There you go. And I can't tell you how many times, especially at a garden talk show on Fridays or even some of my other Wednesday shows, where people call and say, how do I attract this bird or that animal to my home? So there's a lot of, I know there are a lot of people out there who have that interest and really want to do something. So this sounds like the perfect setting for it.
Hopefully it is. And hopefully people are going to be interested want to attend on April 14th. So definitely we'd love to have you come out. And if there's enough interest after that 4-hour workshop, we'd also host some kind of a field trip tour where we can go out and around the city of Madison and actually show people what we've been talking about in the classroom and talk about some things that they could be done in, you know, different spots of yards and things like that. And so it could be, hopefully a very beneficial thing. And hopefully this is just the start. We'd like to start having a bunch of workshops like this to really
do them around the state.
Have them around the state. And outside, we're starting to talk to people in Chicago and Cleveland and Milwaukee about holding workshops like this as well. And we'd like to expand beyond that, too.
You know, Angel emailed to say, and this is a totally different topic, but yesterday her husband observed a robin with a 6-inch stick in its beak. It was hopping around and poking about 6 holes in the snow every few steps. This was during the snowstorm in Green Bay area. Any idea why? He said it was very deliberate, and he observed it for quite a long time. So that robin sat there with about a 6-inch stick, poking holes, do a half a dozen holes or whatever in the snow, and then it'd move on, hoping maybe that a worm was going to peek through the snow.
Or maybe just incredulous, like, really? Snow, April 3rd, April 4th? Are you serious?
Yeah, I was taking measurements.
Yeah,
the snow
for
depth.
Sure. You know, that's a good question. I don't know, Jamie. Maybe you've got an idea, but I'm not sure why a robin would do that. I know there are, a crow species, New Caledonian crows, that will actually use sticks as tools in order to pry insects out of crevices in rock or trees and things like that. So there are some known instances where birds will use tools to help to extricate food, and maybe that's what this robin is doing, is trying to probe for food in some capacity.
I bet that would be the case.
Yeah, I have never witnessed that either. Maybe we'll have some other callers that can share that observation. Right now, the robins by me are picking the last of the crab apples and berries that are hanging on.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
And wondering what happened and why we've got however many inches of snow this morning. But yeah, it sounds like very deliberate behavior, and wildlife don't typically do things without purpose.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us. And an open couple of open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your wildlife question or comment. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Let's take a call. Herb in Price County, it's your turn. Thanks for calling, Herb.
Yes, there was a trophy elk horn found in a meadow in our neighboring homestead here in 1890. It was used as a trophy for quite a few years. Then it was a conversation piece that there had been elk in our neighborhood here hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, and certainly Price County would have been in the, and you know, still is in prime elk habitat, and would have been part of that. Elk were extirpated in the mid to late 1800s, and the first reintroduction effort was back in the 1930s, but that effort failed due to poaching. And the last four elk were reportedly killed in 1948. Then we went through a pause in time before there were, you know, kind of reassessed the situation and then started reintroduction efforts again in the Clam Lake area in 1995. So those would be... antler from the historic, you know,
that pretty,
population.
Pretty darn cool. Yeah. And as long as it was found and taken inside, so the critters didn't
the
get it.
Right? And everything else, yeah.
They get eaten up pretty quickly out in the field.
Yeah, sheds, you often, if you're out shed hunting this spring, you'll notice that there's a lot of rodent or incisors. Yep, yeah. Chewing and gnawing after that. The minerals and nutrients.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool story, Herb. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll take a call from Sherry in Elkhorn next. Sherry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I just had a quick question. I wondered if you had to worry about the elk having chronic wasting disease.
Sherry, that's a good question, and certainly elk are susceptible to chronic wasting disease, but the elk that they're bringing into the state, so the Clam Lake population was established before CWD hit Wisconsin, but the elk that they're bringing in from Kentucky over this five-year reintroduction, they're going through a multi-phase isolation process. There's state veterinarians both in Kentucky and here in Wisconsin that are monitoring the health of those animals. They're taking health samples, and they're actually holding these animals or quarantining these animals for an extended period of time to make sure they get the samples back and they're all clean, but also to make sure that they've got the best opportunity to demonstrate that these animals are healthy. But elk certainly are a susceptible species, but the DNR is doing everything in their control to make sure that they're not bringing CWD elk into Wisconsin. And the other reason they selected elk from Kentucky is because Kentucky does not have CWD, or at the time that they started this reintroduction, Kentucky did not have CWD.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay, so anybody who gets a permit doesn't have to have them tested, is that right?
I was thinking that as you asked that question. I wouldn't be surprised. I've not seen it in print, but I wouldn't be surprised if the state will have in-person registration and maybe do some disease surveillance off of any harvested animals, and not just for CWD, but just even ticks and other. Parasites and so on that they might take a look. But I have not seen anything written yet.
Oh, okay.
All right,
thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Sherry. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Bob in Madison next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I was out at Yellowstone earlier this year and got interested in the elk and the wolves. And I'm kind of wondering how the wolves in Wisconsin will play in with the elk coming in. And there's so much politics that, you know, they opened up hunting season on wolves out in Wyoming and I think Montana and Utah now. And the wolves kind of get a bad rap, but they really do manage the herd of elk in Yellowstone. So is this going to be anything similar to that?
Yeah.
Well, it took a long time for the original Clam Lake herd to have wolf predation. So it was a behavior that wolves, you know, kind of had to learn the hunting strategy to be able to take down a large elk. There certainly have been elk mortalities, both with the new reintroduction and in the Clam Lake area. The thought is that we'll have a robust enough population with quality habitat that predation will be a piece of the system, but not enough to impact the ability of elk to reproduce and have a population. So, I mean, there's certainly been elk that have been hit by cars. There's a lot of mitigation work done with signage and flashing lights to alert drivers on roadways. Baiting and feeding was an issue early on, too, where elk were crossing rivers that weren't completely frozen in order to get to a feeding site or and then drowning. So they have endured different types of mortality, but still maintaining their population viability.
Yeah. Bob, just as an aside, since you mentioned Yellowstone, there was a fascinating paper published a couple of years ago about how wolves completely changed the ecosystem of Yellowstone. And I think if you Google Yellowstone ecosystem and wolves and elk, you probably will find that paper. But essentially, elk population was growing. And when wolves started coming back into Yellowstone, they actually controlled the elk population. And the over-browsing of trees along streams and things like that stopped or was reduced because the wolves were starting to reduce the number of elk. And that changed then the ecosystem of some of those streams and kind of the Yellowstone area. So it was a fascinating paper about how instrumental wolves can be in, from a positive standpoint on ecosystems.
I actually saw a YouTube on that as well that was really, really interesting on the positive impact wolves had in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
It was really a fascinating, not a long piece at all, but it was really interesting.
Yeah, and it was the other thing that's so unique about that or interesting about that is just to see how interconnected things are in nature.
Yeah.
And that either YouTube or that paper will demonstrate that for you.
Yeah, interesting.
If we had more wolves in Wisconsin, would that be a play on CWD then?
Probably not so much because CWD, although it's spreading throughout the state now, it's still concentrated to a large extent down in the southern part of the state where wolves are not. So, you know, unless wolves come down to the southern part of the state, which is highly unlikely, it probably wouldn't have any effect on CWD.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Bob. Appreciate your call. Wow, lots of callers online here. Let's go to Saria in Milwaukee next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, my name is Sadia.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for having the call.
Sure.
So I was walking through the woods the other day, and I seen a fox, and I just wanted to wonder if it was, like, dangerous or not. I could have died back there, you know.
Well, Saria, thanks for the call. I do a lot of research on red fox in urban areas, and it looks like you're from Milwaukee, so I'm gonna include you in an urban area. It is highly unlikely that you're gonna die back there unless you do something, you know, foolish. Or, but there's nothing back there that hurts you, and we would encourage you to get out and enjoy the outdoors and fresh air and things like that. But for the most part, red foxes are not gonna hurt you at all. They're a small animal, only about 15 pounds at the largest. There is a fox strain of rabies, but that is not up in this area. That's down along the Gulf Coast of the United States, Texas, and areas like that. So for the most part, fox are not going to be any problem to you. They're not going to pose a health risk to you. And I would encourage you to, next time you see that fox, just sit and enjoy watching that animal.
Yeah.
Thank you. And one more question.
Yeah.
So I was like petting it. Could I get rabies from petting it?
You were petting it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I would encourage you not to do that next time. But no, unless the animal bit you or scratched you and transferred some kind of body fluid from itself to you, there's very unlikely you get rabies and just from petting it.
If you petted it, yeah.
Yeah, but I would in the future, I would not pet a red fox or any other wild animal just for your safety and the animal's safety as well.
Yeah, and there may be mangerticks and
yeah,
so forth.
All sorts
on
of other
them.
Stuff like that. Plus, if they do bite you, then just for your safety, if you can't actually catch that animal and have the animal's brain tested for rabies, for your safety, you would probably want to go through the rabies series of vaccinations, which is not what it used to be 20 years ago, but it's still not a pleasant thing to do.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Mike in Mazamani. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I'm wondering if it's cost-effective to bring in elk from Kentucky to build the Black Earth herd when we're harvesting elk in the Clam Lake herd. Wouldn't it be better to bring Clam Lake elk to the Black River herd and maybe save some money?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of this reintroduction effort, so for example, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has contributed $1.6 million over the years to help bring in or reintroduce elk into the state. So very little state dollars have been part of the effort for reintroduction. It's really through partnerships, donors. The Ho-Chunk Nation has had a big role in being a partner and wanting to bring elk back into the state. So it's probably a matter of that herd, the Clam Lake herd, not being quite large enough to be able to translocate animals to Jackson County, which makes it sound may make you question why we're harvesting animals. But again, when you think about the wildlife dynamics, we're able to harvest males, the bulls, because they are not all needed in order to breed all of the cows. They certainly wouldn't start harvesting cows at this point. So I think, you know, the state dollars aren't coming into it. They probably would, you know, come into it if it was relocating animals or translocating from Clam Lake to Jackson.
I wouldn't be surprised, though, if they did some of that just as a genetics thing.
Well, that's the other thing I was going
to
say.
And that's the other piece of it is the genetics that need to get introduced to have some more viability to that population. And I would suppose in the future, once we've introduced some of those genetics, there will be some translocations within herds to spread out where they are areas that they're populating in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks a lot for that. And, you know, we're kind of lucky, you know, like the Clam Lake area, we're lucky to have the contiguous, the forest land that we've got there and in Black River Falls.
And they're spending a lot of money on habitat management, creating wildlife openings, which provides the young early successional forest species, the browse that the elk need as well, plus the areas to bugle.
Plus it benefits, even though we're focusing on elk, it benefits just a tremendous host of other species that are not elk in addition. And we should say, although we are focusing on elk reintroductions now, reintroducing other species into the states, not just Wisconsin, but this goes on in states all across the country to restore native populations that have been decimated or extirpated. This is not an uncommon thing to do, and you know, this gets into more of a philosophical debate about societal values, but you know, clearly our society values enough to spend that kind of money or that resource to restore some of the native biodiversity, and we think that it's more beneficial than it is detrimental.
Yeah. Tim in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yes, I have a couple of questions. First of all, there's a elk farm between Cochrane, Wisconsin, and Buffalo City. Pretty substantial, actually. They've got, seems to me, 40 or more elk there. And I'm wondering why those elk can't be used. They're raised right here in Wisconsin. And if not, I wonder what's the motive. I wonder why people are raising them. Number one, And number two, you just mentioned to that young man in Milwaukee that he might catch mange from a fox. I didn't know that was possible, but am I wrong about that? I didn't know people could catch mange from an animal, but if maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well,
yeah, that was me speaking about the mange.
Tim, I'll handle the mange, and then I'll turn it over to Jamie about the captive elk herds. So mange, there's three different types of mange. The sarcoptic mange is the most common type that we experience here. And that is due to a mite, an ectoparasite that actually gets under the skin of the animal, and it causes the follicles to die, and the hair falls out, or as the animal is scratching so much to kind of diffuse that itch of the mite, they actually scratch the hair out. And so, so mange is a rather common issue, especially amongst mammals because of that fur. And it is not a very nice thing to have. I certainly would not want to die of mange. And I feel very bad for the animals that have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other question was about elk. Pen-raised elk. And why we don't maybe consider using some of those for the wild reintroductions or the reintroductions. And why people in general participate in that business or that opportunity. And so they're... First of all, cervid farms, so deer and elk in the state, are overseen by the Department of Ag...
Transportation Consumer Products.
Ag Trade and Consumer Protection.
Yeah, DADCAP. And so they are not overseen by the Department of Natural Resources, which oversees wild animals. So because they're domesticated in a pen facility, they're overseen by DADCAP. And there are certain regulations that they have to abide by in terms of testing upon... the animal being killed, fencing regulations that they have to adhere to, inspections, and so on. So when it comes to reintroducing native species, it is going to be more successful to be reintroducing wild animals than domesticated animals that were born in a captive facility. So that's part of it. And then the other aspect of just in terms of why they are raising deer, there's financial gain in terms of the meat, and there's also antlers,
hide,
urine, lots of different products that can come out of the cervid industry.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And it's sort of like thinking about introducing a tamed animal.
Yep.
I think you kind of touched on that.
You want to have the best genetics possible, ones that have been, you know, able to avoid predation and aspects like that.
Let's turn to Stan in Hayward next. Stan, hello. Thanks for calling. Stan, are you there? Oh, must have lost Stan. All right. Well, let's go on to Ann in Madison then. Hi, Ann. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. So yesterday morning around 4:30, I was sitting out on my patio, and I heard, a scream. And I wasn't sure if it was an animal or a person, and it repeated, and I could tell it was moving around. And I was just afraid it might be a person screaming in distress. So I called 911. And they called me back about 10 minutes later and said it was fox. It was two fox.
Huh.
Well, fox, we're talking about red fox here. Fox have a whole series of different calls they can make. So they can bark like a dog, they can howl, they can scream, and a range of other vocalizations as well. And it is possible it could be a fox, but fox by now are having, they're birthing young, birthing kits. So it would not necessarily be a mating call per se that you heard, but there are other animals that will scream as well. I mean, I don't know if you ever heard a rabbit scream, but that's interesting in and of itself. We don't necessarily have bobcats in Madison, but bobcats scream, and that is a kind of a blood-curdling scream that will raise the hair on the back of your neck very quickly. So it very well might be a fox, but it could be other animals out there as well, Ann.
Yeah, and birds, too.
Yeah, I mean, some owls. Birds will. Yep, the screech owl will scream as well, yep.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Ann. Appreciate your call. And now let's go to Dave in Lancaster. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. It's just that there's something that bothers me. I'm not against hunting. Hunting's fine for animals and whatever. But the term keeps getting used is harvesting instead of killing deer, killing elk, killing whatever. It's always harvesting. I'm wondering, why do they use the word harvesting? I think of harvesting as harvesting corn, harvesting wheat, whatever else, crops, not animals. So,
yeah. Okay.
Well, I can speak to that just personally, having gone through an undergraduate and a master's degree program in wildlife management. So personally, harvest to me involves a bit more than simply killing. Just the outcome is the same. You can use the words interchangeably. The outcome of harvesting your corn crop, the corn plant is dead.
Dies.
You've killed it. To me, harvest... Maybe it's just being politically correct, trying to soften the killing. But it, to me, harvest, or when you hunt and you harvest, it entails much more than killing. Hunting is much more than killing the animal. The scouting, the effort that goes into it. But also, Aldo Leopold, father of wildlife management, professor here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in our department, also likened wildlife management or game management, which is really... evolved over time to include non-game as well, to harvesting the surplus of animals. So wildlife management was managing for a surplus that could be harvested. So that term was used in the early 1930s as well by Leopold. But, you know, when the state, the Department of Natural Resources, sets goals or quota recommendations, permit levels, a lot of that are considered, you know, a harvest authorization. We have harvest management strategies. It's a term that has always been part of management, where killing to me is an instant in time.
Mm-hmm.
But I no doubt the outcome
is the same.
Yeah. But I think from a professional standpoint, I tend to revert to that harvest for personal reason, but also from schooling and the management side.
Yeah, I would agree with everything Jamie said, and just add one thing. As Jamie mentioned, when you're taking an animal or harvesting, be it through trapping or shooting through a gun or bow, or you're fishing or whatever the case is, you're skimming off that surplus. And so harvest also implies sustainability or a sustainable killing of that species. And so that's why we use harvest also, because it has more of a research connotation to it, and it does imply sustainability about that harvest.
There we go. Dave, thank you so much for calling. David Drake and Jamie Neck, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Neck from the UW Extension and UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them along. And thanks for listening in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Carol in Wisconsin Rapids emailed to say her neighbor has found 8 dead red poles in her yard in the last few weeks. They weren't damaged, didn't look sick. None of the other birds at her feeder are dying. What could this be?
You know, Carol, that's a good question. And I guess I would maybe suggest that you call the county biologist in your area. And I think Wisconsin Rapids has a DNR service center. You can give them a call and just report that and see if they'd be interested in maybe collecting the red poles for analysis or study. Because typically, you know, we suggest if a number of the same species has died in a short period of time, there's something going on other than just natural mortality. And so it's likely there's something else going on. But, you know, red poles are moving right now, migrating through. And so they may have picked something up because they'll migrate as a flock. They may have picked something up further north and it poisoned them. And it just all of a sudden worked through the system and hit them at your feeder. So it may not be something necessarily going at your feeder, and suggestive that no other birds are dying at your feeder would suggest that whatever's going on at your feeder is independent of what's happening to the red poles.
Hmm.
Yeah, and there's always the possibility that it's just they're simply emaciated from traveling. Sometimes you can feel along their keel or their breastbone, and you can, if it's real pronounced, that would be an indication of some degradation of muscle and fat reserves.
Yep, for sure.
Let's go to Rich in Madison next. Hi, Rich. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. When I first got back in my car, you guys were talking about, it was about 15 minutes ago, and you had mentioned the need to add more genetics, I believe is how it was put, like to the elk herd, before you can expand like the hunt. I think I was understanding it right. Can you just speak to what adding more genetics to the herd means? Is that just like you're allowing them to reproduce more so that you get a larger like sample? Could you just kind of enlighten me a little bit on that, please?
Yes. Sure. Sorry about that, Rich. So the caller had asked is if there's a surplus of elk in the Clam Lake herd, why don't they take those elk and bring them down to the Black River Falls area to reintroduce elk in that area versus the expense of bringing elk up from Kentucky? And so one of the things that we had addressed with that is that one of the possibilities for bringing elk up from Kentucky is it does allow the Department of Natural Resources to expand the genetic diversity of the elk herd statewide. So if for some reason, if the Clam Lake population, the Black Earth population, or Black River Falls population actually expands so much that they meet in the middle, you do have more genetic swapping or genetic diversity in the elk population. And or if the DNR wanted to take elk from Black River Falls and truck them up to Clam Lake and then take elk from Clam Lake and truck them down to Black River Falls, you do have the ability then to increase the genetic diversity of the elk population that way as well. So that's what we were talking about in terms of providing some context.
And so it's, and genetic diversity breeds, so to speak, a hybrid vigor, as they call it,
yep,
and you get a healthier animal.
That's right.
Yeah, it prevents inbreeding
and a lot of disease. Yeah.
Defects that come as a result.
On to Martin in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Martin.
Hi. Listen, thanks for taking my call. It sounds great introducing elk, and I like that. It sounds like a lot of interesting and fun. I have a question about, does this help the natural predators like the wolf and the cougar? And does this bring in cougars and wolves to the area? Not that I'm against that. Do you have any thoughts about that? And I'll hang up and listen to you guys.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for calling.
So predators on elk, if you went to the Department of Natural Resources website and did a search for elk, you could get kind of an outlook in terms of elk management. And I don't know that they've done predation studies specifically, but typically these animals are radio collared. So if there's a mortality signal, biologists will go in and get to the elk and try to assess what caused that death. And so, as we mentioned earlier, elk in Wisconsin have been have died from
variety
drowning,
of
from being hit by cars, from elk. Certainly, black bears would be a potential predator. Early during the calving season on white-tailed deer, there is a few weeks of time where that fawn is susceptible because it's hidden, and a black bear just opportunistically comes across it and is able to capture that fawn. Once they are on their feet, and they're usually able to outrun a bear. Cougars are not established in the state, so bringing in elk isn't going to have an effect on cougars. The cougars that have been documented in the state have all been young dispersing males from the South Dakota population. So we do not have a breeding population of cougar. They tend to continue to move and travel great distances in a fairly short period of time. And so from a wolf standpoint, we have just, approximately 1,000 wolves in the state. The Clam Lake herd of elk, we're looking at about 200 animals roughly, and a deer herd of over 1 million. So there's a lot more deer for the wolves to potentially feed on than there are elk. And estimates from research that's been done on wolf diets, a wolf is thought to average 17 to 19, somewhere in that ballpark, deer per year. So really to have an effect on that population in northern Wisconsin, they'd really have to key in on a local herd to have an effect. Probably maybe change some behavior, but not necessarily impact the population level.
Patricia in Madison, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, and good morning, Larry and guests. Continuing, I have two questions and a comment, please. Continuing on that cougar, excuse me, what has become of that cougar or mountain lion that was detected on the home security camera around Milwaukee?
So that animal, you know, that animal is not collared, so we can't maintain, you know, its whereabouts or, you know, have direct information on where that animal is. But the state maintains on the Department of Natural Resources website a cougar sighting page that allows people to kind of track it after it's been in the news the first time. They don't typically keep releasing press releases on updates. But you could try going to the department's website, type in cougar. And like I said, they have a cougar sighting page and they'll kind of follow if people pick them up on like trail cameras. And so it has to be confirmed mountain lion or cougar, same animal, by a biologist. And the only way they can do that is either by confirming a trail camera photo or by confirming a track. So there has to be some evidence, not just a, you know, somebody saying, I saw a cougar.
Yeah.
They have to have some type of evidence to prove it. And then they kind of track those animals. I haven't heard anything lately, but...
It may have moved on.
It may have moved on out of state. It, you know, we may pick it up today somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah.
My other question was... does the Poinette Game Farm still exist? I know it became the McKenzie Environmental Center, but they used to have a wonderful game farm there that my children enjoyed when they were young.
Yeah.
Well, my husband actually used to help manage the Poinette State Game Farm, and it does exist. They, in the past, have raised all sorts of animals within their history, but they only raise ringneck pheasants at this point. The state is stocking about 75,000 pheasants a year in most recent years. They actually just dedicated their new hatchery a couple weeks ago. So the pheasant facility there, the pheasant farm, is certainly alive and well. And then the McKenzie Center is also there, where they're doing outreach programs for youth and adults and have a residential, you know, ability for residential programs as well in the summer with different youth groups and so on. So the Environmental Center is there, and they have a small zoo that contains only native Wisconsin animals, and typically those are animals that have had some type of a story or a history, whether they've been injured by a vehicle or a mother was killed and they were orphaned. Those animals have come from some type of background that they've been used as educational species.
And my comment is, I had the opportunity to be in Montana a couple years ago, and I don't know where it was located in Montana, but... it was the Rocky Mountain Foundation Center that has all the elk displays, and it's a marvelous museum, if you want to call it that, and has an interactive program where you can enter different states and find out about the elk populations and the history of how they came to those states. And, of course, I looked up Wisconsin, and so it was already saying about the ones that had been brought from Michigan. Mm. And it was very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wisconsin also has a interpretive display or kiosk right in Clam Lake, too, that talks about its history. And as we mentioned earlier, I mean, another reason for bringing these elk and maintaining this reintroduction effort is the tourism. And for hunters and non-hunters alike, being able to see an elk or hear it bugle, there's just something magical about that.
Yeah.
Do you know where that center was in Montana?
I don't know for sure what city, but we could look up the headquarters for Rocky Mountain Elk pretty quickly on the
okay.
internet and find that out.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And Ray in Seattle, Washington, your turn. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I know that sounds strange, but I'm a Wisconsin native. By streaming, I listen to the home state radio station, and the Larry Mailer Show is one of my favorites.
Thank you.
Especially when it's about nature and wildlife and fishing. I just wanted to add something quickly to part of the previous discussion where in which a caller... questioned the use of the word harvest and suggested killing instead. Well, I think we should add to that that Aldo Leopold regarded wildlife as a crop. And when you have a crop, you harvest it, and then you do something with it. You eat it, you make it into a trophy, and so on. So aspect of using it after you kill it. I just wanted to bring that out, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, yeah, thanks, Ray, and thanks for listening to the show.
Yeah, that was in Game Management. Yeah, he referenced wildlife as a crop, and that is one of the things in the North American model of wildlife conservation is if you're going to kill or harvest an animal, that you use that animal. You don't just kill the animal and let it weigh to waste.
Yeah,
or lay to waste.
Thanks, Ray. I'm glad you're listening and appreciate your call. Let's go to James in Wakefield next. Hi, James.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've got the answers on that. Those red pole deaths.
Yeah.
Mold grows on those shells and seeds of the thistle on the ground. If it's on the ground for a prolonged period of time, and as it warms up, that mold will gather and grow on those seeds and on the shells. Those birds are picking on the ground. It will kill those birds. It'll kill those red poles. You gotta clean up underneath those feeders occasionally. Get all that shell in the seed that wasn't eaten and that had fallen out of the feeders. Got to get that up off the ground and clean up, and you won't see those red poles dying anymore.
Yeah,
that's a good suggestion just about feeder maintenance in general. But and you're right that with mold on seeds and from the ground, but also if your feeder gets wet and the seed in the side of the feeder gets wet, you can get mold there as well. But that wouldn't answer the question because she's not seen any other species of birds coming to her feeder dying. And if that was the case, that the red poles were eating moldy seed, you would think it would affect other birds like finches and some of doves and birds like that also are feeding on the ground.
There we go. Good points, though. Thank you very much for calling. David Drake and Jamie Knack, our guests today. Great to have them along. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests talking about the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin. David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening. We have callers online. I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Linda in Plymouth next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I listen to your show every day.
Thank you.
Okay. So over the weekend, we were in Hayward, Wisconsin, and we spotted two hawks that I first thought were eagles, and then I looked, no, those were hawks. And I did a little research, and they were the rough-legged hawk.
Yeah.
And the only time we've ever seen those were in Upper Michigan. Have they always been in Wisconsin, and we've just now starting to see them?
Yes. Well, no. Whether you've seen them or not before, I can't answer that question. But they have always been in Wisconsin, and they come into our state in the winter, and then they go up into far northern Canada in the summer. And that's their summer range. So they will be down here in the wintertime, and now's the time you'd start seeing them moving through to go back up north.
How far south in Wisconsin do you see them?
Well, their wintering range can be throughout all of the 48 contiguous states in the United States, more or less. So you can definitely see them throughout all of Wisconsin in the wintertime.
Oh, that is so interesting, because we got so excited because I said, I haven't seen those before in Wisconsin.
Well, it is exciting to see them because they're not, I don't know that you see them all that frequently. So, the population, to my knowledge, is not in danger of collapsing or anything like that. I think that the population is very healthy, but you just don't see them all. They're not as common a hawk as for example, a red-tailed hawk or a Cooper's or a sharpshin or something like that. So it is exciting when you see them just because you don't see them every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were just absolutely beautiful. And we saw two swans in the Nibicagan River.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Just north of Springbrook.
So you had a good day.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Thanks, Linda. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Very cool. Well, Pat in Three Lakes has something for us. Pat, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I read an article, I forgot where it was from, but there was a professor from University of California, LA or USC, one of them, did a study from 1990 to 2012 on the walleye population in northern lakes, and found out that they decreased 67% on some lakes and 43% on others. And I was wondering, you know, I know that some of the lakes in Minnesota have shut down walleye fishing, and so has the Manaquacoon. If walleye is going to be a non-sustainable resource, has there been any research done on that?
Pat, you're a little bit out of our wheelhouse on this question, so this would be a great question to call your local fisheries biologist, or if it's particularly in the Minocqua chain or a certain, you know, portion of Wisconsin, Winnebago system or whatever, to talk to that local biologist and ask a little bit about the walleye population and what the management goals are. They certainly would be reviewing management plans for fish species, just like we do for terrestrial wildlife. I know for looking at the advisory questions on the spring hearings, which are coming up this next Monday at 7 o'clock in all of the counties, there's an advisory question about in the Winnebago system about reducing the bag limit on walleye from 5 to 3. And certainly an effort like that would be in regards to recovering or increasing a population as the goal for that. So I'd encourage you to take a look at the spring hearing advisory questions, which are available on the Department of Natural Resources website, and calling a local fisheries biologist, you'll get a much better answer than I can give you.
But I will say that as popular as walleye are as a game fish, that there is a lot of interest in research and monitoring going on, and I guarantee you that there's interest in increasing the population so that you can have a sustainable fishery.
It's sort of been at the expense, and I've done some shows that relate to this, that the bass populations mm-hmm. in a lot of northern lakes has increased.
Exploding.
Yeah.
Exploding at sort of, and while the walleye population drops.
Yep, and so there's been more liberal bag limits and size class for bass.
Yeah.
As a result.
Yeah, for sure. Well, as long as we're at those hearings, maybe we should mention or talk a little bit more about those hearings. You certainly want people to participate in them.
Yeah, so every spring, the state of Wisconsin offers the opportunity to anybody, not just hunters and anglers, but anybody interested in natural resource management, the opportunity to have their voice heard at the spring hearings is what they're typically referred to as. They'll be occurring on Monday, April 9th. There'll be a hearing in every county of the state. You can go to the DNR's website and determine what that location is for your particular county, and they begin at 7 o'clock. It's an opportunity for the public to provide input, although it's non-binding. It's a non-binding vote. You can also provide testimony to the Department of Natural Resources, the Natural Resources Board, and the Conservation Congress on proposed rule changes and advisory questions that relate to fisheries and wildlife. And typically then they're divided. They alternate years on whether they do the fishery advisory questions first or the wildlife advisory questions. In case you're only particularly interested in one or the other, you can determine when you arrive. And then county residents also have the option to run for a seat on the Conservation Congress and to elect delegates to represent their county's interests. So again, the DNR's website would be the place to go next, so you can take a look at what the advisory questions are for this coming year, and also you can show up and help elect your county delegates. So this really is a unique opportunity in our state, and the Conservation Congress is certainly unique across the country in allowing public input into natural resource management.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Pat. Appreciate your call. Mary in Clam Lake, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm actually on the West Fork of the Chippewa River, and I was very excited because I finally got to see an elk. But my question is, he's all by himself. He just comes along with the deer, it looks like. Not right with them, but when the deer come, then he shows up. Aren't they supposed to be in a herd?
Yeah. They are a herd animal, and I'd be willing to bet that there's cows and other animals in the in the vicinity, but they are so camouflaged to their local environment. The other animals may be bedded down, but they are not too far away.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Get you on pretty quickly. Jim and Rhinelander, your turn.
Hey, I've got a question for your guest. I was photographing short-eared owls this winter down in the southern part of the state, and it seemed like they hit the ground a lot during their hunting, and I was curious, are they, you know, missing that many rodents, or are they misidentifying what they're pouncing on, or is this a method where they hit the ground and lift up right away in hopes that they're scattering something? It just seemed like they are on the ground a lot for a real short period of time, and it seems like a lot of energy being spent if they're not actually, you know, grabbing a mouse. Now, they might have grabbed mice, and I couldn't see. The grass was tall, and they might swallow it right away. I'm just not sure, but I just thought compared to, like, a harrier, they are on the ground a lot.
Yeah, Jim, that's a good question. As Jamie mentioned earlier in the show, you know, wildlife – always do something with a purpose. And so that animal was most likely hunting, and they're hunting voles, most likely meadow voles, V-O-L-E-S. It could have been a different variety of mice out there as well. And even though they're hunting all the time, they're not always successful. So they may be hitting the ground and not coming up with anything. But also, you know, that short-eared owl is a pretty big bird, and those talons are pretty large. So it could be also having a vole in its talons that you just may not see, especially if you're from a distance away.
They're pretty small.
The voles are pretty small, as are the mice. But they would go and then sit down someplace and eat that animal. They would not eat it on the wing.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for that call. Cynthia from Stevens Point emailed to say that some people feel a natural resources degree is limited to a technical degree, in that it doesn't require critical thinking. This may relate to UW Stevens' point here. how do people in the natural resources field use critical thinking?
Yeah, that's a good question. I will say this. I think that we do a very poor job at the K-12 and even in the college level of teaching critical thinking skills to people in general. So. But I will say in the natural resources field and wildlife field in particular, we use critical thinking skills every single day, and, you know, be it monitoring, management, research, whatever the case might be. But there's a lot of information out there that we have to process, and we use a variety of, you know, math and statistical models and just curiosity and trying to understand what's going on in that natural world. So we may not always be good at critical thinking, but we do try to employ it every single day in the natural resource and wildlife management field.
Boy, I think about it just in terms of solving wildlife damage questions when you get a phone call from the public and they have, you know, something occurring and you're able to kind of talk through the situation, you know, ask questions, key questions. You're kind of a detective going through the process. Being able to determine what's doing the damage, why it's doing the damage. We've had some great questions or just observations with the robin earlier in the show in terms of why they're doing what they're doing. And I think that's what's so fascinating about this field is you are constantly critically thinking and learning as you go.
Yeah. Are you suggesting we're using critical thinking skills in this show, Jamie?
Possibly, I am.
and you know, you a wildlife biologist, all right, you're studying animals, but you have to be knowledgeable about human behavior as
it
well.
It is much more. We tell our students this over and over and over. Many students start in this field with the idea of working with animals, touching animals every day, and we do a lot less of that and a lot more of working with people and understanding social dynamics, and it's a lot of people management.
It sure is, and we get asked questions all the time, like, well, how many animals are out there? And that's the, you know, animals don't stand still and allow you to count them like trees do, for example. So, you know, just even trying to understand a population estimate it involves quite a bit of critical thinking skills to do that.
Dan emailed to say he thinks he caught a marten on his camera should he contact the DNR about the sighting?
So pine marten, the American marten, is our only endangered mammal in the state. There are not that many, a couple of hundred. And certainly if he would be in Le Chequamegon or the Nicolet National Forest area of the state, that is a possibility, and the staff would certainly want to know about it. So it was an email, so we don't have him on the call to know where that was documented. But if he's in those areas, it could potentially be in a pine marten, and the local biologist would likely be interested in knowing.
And don't they have a reporting form online,
Yeah,
too?
There's a rare mammal observation form that the DNR maintains, so that would be another way to enter that data, and you can share your photo.
Yeah.
And lastly, I think now the northern long-eared bat is also another endangered mammal in the state. It just got listed.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Recently.
Thinking back to my earliest days of hunting in the Chequamegon National Forest, you used to see a lot of pine marten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now you don't.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Now you don't. Well, let's go to Gary in Antigo next. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was thinking about fishing, and since mosquitoes are waterborne, and they carry West Nile virus and other types of diseases, I was wondering, you know, the bait fish eat the mosquito or the larvae, the bigger fish eat the bait fish, and we eat the bigger fish. Has there been any studies done to show that if we might contract something?
So West Nile virus is typically contracted by the bite of a mosquito.
Yeah.
And it goes through, you know, I'm not aware of fish being identified as a intermediate host like birds are. The corvids, blue jays and crows in particular, seem to be susceptible as an intermediate host. And then humans and horses are a terminal host. But I'm not aware of fish getting sick from insects and in particular West Nile virus.
Well, and it's probably a warm-blooded host would be my guess,
yeah,
too.
So right.
Fish being cold-blooded.
Yep.
But again, a fisheries biologist could probably help answer some of those questions about insect-borne diseases and fish.
Interesting question, though. Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Kirk in La Crosse. Hi, Kirk.
Hi there. Couple parts to this question. First part, correct me or enlighten me. Is chronic wasting disease a prion vector like scrapie and mad cow?
Yes.
Okay. And there was a couple of studies I'd heard on this network a couple of months ago that chronic wasting is being picked up in certain crops. They're starting to detect it. This is potentially catastrophic for our food chain. Why is this not a larger concern for the public at large? And why do they insist on, you know, killing the deer at will and not policing themselves?
Not sure what you meant by that last.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Okay. Ducks Across America, they're responsible for the largest amount of conservation of waterfowl in southern United States. Why aren't the hunters up here more active in conservation of the deer herd to prevent the spread of this potentially catastrophic vector?
Okay.
All
right, we'll start with Jamie.
I will start with that one. And it's difficult to address this, but there are a lot of politics involved with chronic wasting disease. There are a lot of politics involved with deer management in Wisconsin. Deer are a keystone species when it comes to determining habitat, so they can have major impacts on habitat, from overbrowsing to regeneration issues. And then you also have a hunting community that's interested in having deer to be able to continue that tradition of harvest. You've got different expectations of how many deer per square mile people would like to see. You've got an insurance agent industry. You've got auto vehicle collisions. You have disease interests or disease concerns. You have an agricultural community that has certainly ag damage issues. And so there are stakeholders on both sides of the equation in terms of how our deer population should be managed. And in fact, right now we're going through the CDACs, the County Deer Advisory Councils, which are made up of representatives from some of these different stakeholder groups that are starting or that will help make decisions on whether a county increases, decreases, or maintains their deer herd based on metrics that they're provided from the state, based on public opinion. So now public input now is a time period, April 2nd to, I want to say, like around the 12th. I don't have that in front of me, where the public can provide input to their county CDACs in terms of what they would like to see from that given deer herd. So, and as far as chronic wasting disease, you know, coming into this, there's certainly research going on. There has been at times a large amount of money going into research and management, the idea of reducing densities because it is a disease that spread from contact. We've had times where we've had the elimination of baiting and feeding. We've gone to different models of that now in more recent years. But there's just a lot of social and political, you know, management or decisions that come into play.
Yeah, and I'll say Wisconsin was one of the few states that aggressively went after chronic wasting disease when it was first discovered here in 2002, where they tried to eradicate as many deer as they possibly could and wanted to get down to a zero level of deer in that chronic wasting zone area. And they just couldn't do it because they didn't get cooperation from the private landowners, and it just wasn't politically feasible. But also economically, they just don't have the resources to conduct the type of aggressive management and monitoring that they started out doing.
And there are some thoughts on, different thoughts on how we might do that. I know there's been something proposed like putting a fairly large amount of money per deer taken in a chronic wasting to deer taken. We talked about that on the show not too long ago.
Yeah.
$1,000.
Yeah, incentives to harvest. The problem is, you know, that the deer themselves don't show clinical signs until they're pretty late stage. So it's hard to just go out and look at a deer, observe a deer, and know whether it has the disease or not. So that makes it an added challenge. And, you know, it's a public resource that the DNR is responsible for managing. However, in many cases, it resides on private property, and you have to have permission to access those animals. So landowners play a big part in terms of what management is done on that private property.
Yeah, so there's
a lot going on. It's not an easy answer.
Yeah. So there you go, Kirk. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Jason from Green Bay a chance. You have a quick question, Jason.
Well, it's probably pretty complicated as well, but I was just wondering your comments on trail cams, the snapshot program. It seems like you can't even go in the woods anymore without being surveilled.
Yeah, the Snapshot Wisconsin program, you know, that is on the, well, it's a tool that we're hoping will help in managing some of the populations and being able to get a better idea of distribution of some of the species like bears or fisher or some of the wolves, maybe even whether we have snowshoe hares and some, you know, where we have snowshoe hares, where we may have marten and fisher. So it's a great tool, and that is certainly something the state's been very sensitive about in terms of surveillance or the idea that people are being captured in pictures. So
something else we can talk about, I guess, on the next time
show.
You two are on the show. I look forward to that. Thanks for that question, Jason. And David and Jamie, thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you.
David Drake and Jamie Knack from UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. We'll be back. We always have a show the first Wednesday of every month, as probably you know. Tomorrow, our consumer protection experts will be back to talk about the Federal Trade Commission's top frauds. Stay with us.